Mr. Briley, you were appointed by the court, and I want to express the court's appreciation to you for your assistance.
You're welcome, Your Honor. Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Michael Zinser. I represent the Hawaii Tribune Herald. It's an honor to be before this court this morning. We're here this morning having filed a petition to review an order of the National Labor Relations Board that issued in February of 2011. This was the worst act of disloyalty that I've ever experienced, and distrust I'd ever experienced, not just there, but anywhere in my professional career. That's what editor David Bach said when he found out that employee Dave Smith had secretly recorded a meeting that they had in the workplace.
It's a little exaggerated. It is the worst case of disloyalty we can all think of.
How many jobs has he had?
Many more terrible things, but I get your point. I get Mr. Bach's point. But
and so on March the 3rd, Mr. Smith...
It wasn't illegal in Hawaii to tape the conversation, right?
It was not a violation of the Hawaii Penal Code.
Right.
That is true, Your Honor, but in terms of the workplace... and governing the workplace.
If Mr. Smith had taken notes during that conversation, would that have been a sign of disloyalty?
No, Your Honor. In fact...
What's the difference between him taking notes and him tape recording the conversation?
It's a matter of honesty. It's a matter of deceit in the workplace. I mean, what kind of workplace would it be if employees could secretly be wired for sound walking around the building? It would be a terrible place. It'd be a terrible place to work. In fact, Mr. Smith, before he engaged in that act, called Wayne Cahill, the administrative officer for the Newspaper Guild, and Mr. Cahill did not tell him to surreptitiously record the meeting. He told him to go into the meeting and take notes. Mr. Smith didn't follow that advice.
What's the purpose of taking notes in the meeting? What does that suggest about the nature of the relationship between Mr. Bach and Mr. Smith? There's one of distrust, right? I mean,
I think the record indicates that Mr. Bach would tell you, Your Honor, that he had a good relationship with Mr. Smith until this.
Someone comes into my office and starts taking notes when I talk to them. What's that convey?
I can't climb into the head of Mr. Smith. Mm-hmm. It may convey a lot of things. It may just, you know, so that I can recall later what happened. I take notes.
It's creating a record because you're in an adversarial setting, right? That's what's going on here. It's creating a record because it's an adversarial setting.
That's what Mr. Smith should have done if he wanted a record of what was going to happen. He knew in advance that he was not going to be allowed to have a union representative in the meeting. So in an act of insubordination, he, before he went into the room, started this device and secretly recorded the meeting. Now, but for the fact that a loyal employee, after thinking about it a couple days, went to Mr. Bach, did he learn about it? And her words were, I thought I was observing junior high antics. It was disgusting, and I felt ashamed for my fellow employees. And so she shared with Mr. Bach what happened. Now, Mr. Bach didn't just...
Why didn't Mr. Bach allow a witness to come in when Smith, when he was interviewing Smith?
It was not a Weingarten opportunity. Mm-hmm. There was no right for the employee to have a union representative.
Did Smith share that view?
It's pretty clear from the record, Your Honor, that Mr. Smith did not understand the circumstances under which he was entitled to a Weingarten representative under that case. He had a mistaken subjective belief. And the proof that that's the case is that on his behalf, the unions filed specific unfair labor practice charges that his right to have a Weingarten representative was unlawfully denied, and all of those charges were withdrawn. So clearly, and further evidence of that is the fact that the recording that was made when Hawaii Tribune Herald petitioned for it through a subpoena at the hearing and was denied, I have to believe that if that recording revealed illegal activity, the NLRB would have issued a complaint, and that would have been an allegation of the case, and it wasn't. So clearly, this was not that opportunity. And secret recording is wrong. Karen Welch knew it was wrong. Peter Stone knew it was wrong.
Well, the board looked at it from the point of view, as Judge Griffith suggested, there was no law in Hawaii prohibiting it. The employer had no rule. There's no challenge that it was concerted activity. The mutual aid and assistance provision is supposed to be liberally interpreted, as the board has. And the board said, you know, under these circumstances, and given the board's precedent that such action is not malum in se, you know, there was, how could this court find that there was not substantial evidence to support the board's?
I don't think it's a reasonable interpretation of the National Labor Relations Act for the National Labor Relations Board to find that we're going to sanction honesty and deceit in the workplace as protected activity. And the truth of the matter is, Your Honor, precedent that was in effect at the time, and as far as I know, has never been overruled, is an NLRB case called Elko, where that court, I'm sorry, the board in that case specifically held, you know, you don't have to have a rule for everything. Sometimes something occurs in a workplace and you just have to deal with it. And so
that's the current precedent.
Who
gets to decide that that's wrong to tape record a conversation? You think it's wrong? On what basis do you think it's wrong?
It's disloyal and it's dishonest.
How so?
On its face. I mean, to secretly meet with your supervisor and come in wired for sound, that's a despicable act of disloyalty, and it shouldn't be allowed to allow that kind of activity to occur. I mean, if that is allowed to stand, if that ruling is allowed to stand, then the NLRB has basically performed a total workaround the principles that the U.S. Supreme Court established in the Weingarten case. I mean, there are circumstances.
In the
Weingarten case.
How so?
Well, that case established the parameters under which an employer can meet with an employee without a union representative, and the circumstances under which an employee can meet and have the right to a representative. So it established the rules. In this case, Mr. Smith said, well, I'm going to have my witness, regardless of what the law is, I'm going to secretly record.
The board found that there was a reasonable basis for the employees to think that their right was being denied. All right, it's not a question of, is Mr. Smith a lawyer, and, you know, did he know what the union ultimately was going to do with that charge? But at the time the employees reached this conclusion, the board said there was a reasonable basis for them to think that Mr. Mock was going to deny them what they thought was a right that they had.
But as I understand the Supreme Court's decision, it's not a subjective test, but rather it's an objective test.
Well, the board said under all the circumstances, there was reasonable grounds, given what had happened to Mr. Anderson just before, for the employees to have this reasonable view.
We respectfully assert that that's just the decision,
wrong.
Just wrong, just absolutely wrong. I mean, it's not protected activity. It's and the other thing I want to say about Mr. Smith is he could have done, you know, what he did in addition to the secret taping. If you think your employer is violating your rights, that's why we have a National Labor Relations Act. Mm-hmm. And that's why we have a process. And they filed the charges, and they didn't have merit. They had to withdraw them, and that was not an issue in the case. And finally, excuse me.
It's just not, you know as well as I do, it's just not that simple when you're in the workplace and you're feeling intimidated. It's not that easy. Employees aren't thinking about, well, this board process, what's the law? They're thinking about their situation in context and whether they're feeling threatened and trying to protect themselves. The board had ruled that there's no per se rule prohibiting the use of tapes. They said they would take it case by case. That's the law that controlled. And they took it on the facts here, and they said on the facts here, in context, we find that the employee's activity was protected. That's the law. You want a per se rule, and the board had already said there's not going to be a per se rule.
Especially, I think, Your Honor, under the facts and circumstances of this case, that it was wrong to find that it was protected.
But wrong is in your view. I can get a whole lot of people and line you all up, and half the room would say, yeah, I would have done it, and half the room would have said, like you're saying with great vehemence, it's wrong. And it probably would break down on who's on the employer side and who's on the employee side.
Well, Your Honor,
it's not morally wrong. There's no state law against it. It's not morally wrong, and it's hardly surprising that sometimes individuals, and I happen to be aware of some, because I've been around these situations in years past, where people do feel aggrieved, threatened, put upon, and they don't know how else to protect themselves. Why is it different from a person with a photographic memory who can sit there in a short conversation, remember every single word, perfect punctuation that was said, leave the room, and transcribe it? Is that morally wrong?
It's, I think, wrong.
Is that morally wrong? I'm just trying to understand your reach. A person has perfect memory and can leave that room and transcribe it, and it's exactly what happened. Is it morally wrong for that person to do it?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. And what's the difference?
The dishonesty and the deceit in the workplace.
So the person with the perfect recall needs to come in and say, by the way, before you begin, you need to understand that I have perfect recall? And if he doesn't do that, he's being dishonest?
No, Your Honor, that's not what happened here. What happened is
we're talking about hypotheticals. We know what I'm trying, following up on Judge Edwards' question, which I think gets to the heart of the problem with your argument. What's the difference between someone with perfect recall and somebody tape recording?
The dishonesty and deceit it brings to the workplace.
The person with perfect recall does need to say, by the way, I have perfect recall, and I'm going to write everything down.
No, Your Honor.
No, there's no difference between the two.
Think about that. Had Mr. Smith not secretly recorded the meeting, nothing would have ever happened. Nothing would have ever happened to Mr. Smith. And also with respect to Mr. Smith.
You don't know that. It's a self-serving suggestion. There's no way this court or the board or anybody else knows that. We only know what happened. We have no idea what the interaction between the employer and employee would have been absent that recording. We do not know that. And you can't speculate, nor can I. We don't know what the tensions were, and we can't try and recreate them, and you can't self-servingly suggest something that we don't have in the record.
But I can assert, Your Honor, that the record reflects that the sole reason that he was discharged was the ultimate discharge was the disloyal act of surreptitiously recording the meeting. And the other thing that I would say is that, you know, Mr. Smith, you know, essentially fired himself. On April 11, 2006, Mr. Bach said, looking to come back to work, but you need to understand going forward, you know, we're not going to tolerate secret taping in the workplace. And Mr. Smith never responded to that letter or that overture. He could be working there today and come back to work, file his grievance, file his charge, which he did anyway. The union did on his behalf.
That's something that you resolve in the remedy hearing with the board after the fact if you lose here. You're saying it's a mitigating circumstance, not something we decide. You're claiming he got an offer to return. That's something that you present in the remedy hearing.
And that's in this record.
Yeah, but we're not. This isn't the remedy hearing.
I just want to make the point that he could be working there today. Now, with respect to Mr. Bishop, I'm saying this based on my firm belief I will be fired this time. That's from Mr. Bishop's email to his union administrative officer on October the 19th, 2005, shortly after he was suspended. Mr. Bishop knew that he had engaged in serious misconduct that day in his insubordination and disrespect of Editor David Bach. And he knew, he wrote that fully a week before the decision was made to ultimately discharge him. He had a very, very troubled disciplinary history at the newspaper. The record is replete with actual arbitration awards where arbitrators found that very often Mr. Bishop crossed the line and engaged in insubordinate...
He didn't yell at Bach, did he? The ALJ found that he didn't yell. Right. Or he didn't threaten him either.
And we're not alleging that he threatened him.
He didn't yell either, right?
Our contention
he didn't use any profanity, right?
No profanity. But our contention is that at the third...
So what should he have done in that setting? He had a disagreement with Bach. What should he have done?
What he should have done is once Mr. Bach indicated that he was going to have the meeting with Ms. Nocco, he should have gone back to his desk and gone back to work. Then when we got into the meeting with Ms. Nocco, if she requested a union representative, Mr. Bach would have let her have one. As it turned out, she did not request one. Additionally, in that situation also, the union filed an unfair labor practice charge claiming that the company had unlawfully denied Ms. Nocco a union representative in that particular meeting, and that charge also was withdrawn. Again, another situation where they don't seem to understand the parties' respective rights in the workplace.
Who's the they in your sentence?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
You said they don't seem to understand the rights of the parties in the workplace.
I'm referring to Mr. Smith and Ms. Nocco.
Well, the board said it found that Mr. Bishop did not engage in the sort of opprobrious behavior that would result in stripping him of his rights under the statute. I mean, for some of the reasons Judge Griffith was noting, his behavior just didn't go far enough, said the board.
In none of the other cases that Hawaii Tribune Herald had involving Mr. Bishop that are in the record for you, in all of those cases, the union claimed in those cases that they were also unfair labor practices and he was the victim of discrimination. And in every case, the arbitrators considered that issue, said that wasn't the case, said Mr. Bishop crossed the line, and in none of those cases did he use profanity. And in none of those cases were there threats. But I don't think you have to have threats, and I don't think you have to have the use of profanity insubordinate in the workplace.
What did he do to cross the line? It's opprobrious behavior. What was his behavior? Mere insubordination is significant enough?
Well, on the day in question, I mean, he, as Mr. Bach was attempting to have this meeting with one of his employees, Mr. Bishop instigated not one, but three confrontations as they were walking from one part of the building to another. At each confrontation, he was angry, he was red-faced, his voice decibel level continued to rise, and it was a very disruptive situation. All the witnesses that testified about it, some stood up and turned around, other people turned around. It was obviously a very loud, disruptive incident in the workplace. And when one combines that with this individual's long disciplinary history, this employer viewing the entire record, made a really good decision. And what we have in this case is the National Labor Relations Board substituting its judgment for the reasoned judgment of the Hawaii Tribune Herald in this matter. And with respect to the later letter that was sent to Mr. Bishop concerning the story count, nothing pretextual about that. I mean, two of the arbitration cases that are before this court, two of them involved Mr. Bishop's failure to meet the productivity standard, and the arbitrators found, number one, it's a reasonable standard. Number two, there was cause to impose the discipline. There was a verbal warning, there was a written warning, then there was an unpaid suspension. And
so the board found it was just implausible for the employer to say it wasn't aware of this because it kept track of what Bishop and the other employees were doing. In other words, I understand where you're coming from, but understand what our standard of review is.
Mr. Bach testified, and this testimony's not anywhere refuted in the record, that the story count wasn't done for 2005 until late February 2006. And that's when he learned of the story count, sent the letter to Mr. Bishop, and then shortly thereafter had the meetings with employees Armstrong and Smith. And so that's not pretextual, and there's really no, that's in the opinion of the Tribune Herald is speculation on the part of the National Labor Relations Board. And lastly, with respect to Mr.
Well, just to be fair to the board here, the board, my notes say it found that it was implausible that the employer had, quote, no idea, close quote, of Bishop's productivity as it has tracked it for years. That's what the board says.
Well, the only evidence the record about it is the testimony of Mr. Bach, and he testifies that it's something that is ongoing. It's a small community newspaper. It takes a lot of time, and he just had not completed it until after the first of the year. And so it's under the facts and circumstances, it's not implausible, number one. Number two, there's no evidence in the record from any witness that rebuts Mr. Bach on that question. And finally, on the board's decision on Jefferson standard, and that it is not going to apply Jefferson standard in a situation where a discharged employee, but seeking reinstatement of back pay, that a discharged employee in that circumstance does not have a duty of loyalty to the employer.
What was your response to the board's point that you forfeited any argument about the standard?
I don't believe that's true, Your Honor. The under the board's rules, you have the option. You may file a motion for reconsideration, but it's not required. And so, since that was something that the ALJ didn't address, I certainly think that we are at liberty to address it before this honorable court under the board's own rules. I don't think that was correct. And I'm sorry we didn't address that in the brief. We were doing our best to work within the word constraints in view of the size of this record. But I think that decision is just wrong. The Supreme Court didn't mince words. There's no better cause for discharge than disloyalty.
The board cites Section 10E of the statute that says, quote, no objection that has not been urged before the board shall be considered by the court except absent extraordinary circumstances.
That was something we learned about for the first time.
Yeah, but I mean, look,
when the board issued its decision.
Well, that's right. Isn't there case law? I'm sitting here thinking you threw me when you said you had no obligation to see. I thought I had even written something to the contrary.
Well, the board's rules and regulations.
Have an obligation under the statute. If the board says something that's new that you disagree with, I thought you were supposed to raise it with them. I'll have to go back and look at the case law again.
No, they cite a Supreme Court case and a case from this circuit. And I just was asking.
I thought it was a statutory requirement.
Asking you, based on the statute.
Based on the statute.
I was just asking what your response was to it. So, and you cited the
Well, they referenced
this. He's saying he had no obligation, and I'm perplexed. Where did that, is that really your reading? I'm hesitating because I don't remember the case right now, but I certainly thought there was case law that said you do indeed have an obligation to raise it with the board. In precisely this kind of a case where the board says, beginning with the ALJ, says the board said, we're clarifying the law. Here's the law now. You know, you can do your Chevron argument or whatever you want going forward, but here's the law. And you have an obligation, if you want to contest it, to go to them first, I thought.
I thought your argument was that you had raised the Jefferson Standard argument below and that the court, that the board had simply rejected that.
Well, we did that also. But when the board,
Wouldn't that be that you had raised this objection? You had raised this argument below. You presented it to the board. They rejected it, and so now you're seeking review of the board's decision here.
Well, that's also true. I mean, that's true, Your Honor. We did raise it before the ALJ, and
you argued Jefferson Standard before the ALJ, right? And the board rejected that. The board said Jefferson Standard doesn't apply to post-discharge, right?
That's correct.
Okay.
And what I'm arguing here this morning is that that's just, again, wrong as a matter of law. You've got somebody who wants to come back into this workplace. And
that's an argument you made before the ALJ as well, right? In arguing for a Jefferson Standard.
On memory, I believe that's true. And the but Your Honor, it's a matter of just the legal world. I mean, should an employee be allowed seeking reinstatement to be outside attacking the quality of the product of the very company he wants to return to?
Right. And see, the board's point is these are all the arguments you should have presented to it in your motion for reconsideration after the board announced it was overruling its precedent and it was going to apply Daniel Oldsmobile. And so that's where the board's coming from, I think, in this argument. Anyway, let us hear from the board, and we'll give you a minute or two in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, Daniel Blitz for the NLRB. Substantial evidence supports the board's findings that the company committed numerous violations of the act. I'll jump to the situation involving Bishop. It's critical that based on credibility-driven findings, the board found that Bishop did not engage in the type of opprobrious behavior that could potentially take him outside the protection of the act. During his encounter with Editor Bach, he did not yell. He did not use profanity. He did not make any threatening gestures. At bottom, the company's argument to the contrary.
But can't Bach take into account the fact that this fellow had had difficulties with him in the past? Does Bach have to look simply at this one encounter as a silo and it not be part of the longer history here?
To your point, Your Honor, I don't think any human being should be required to step outside of his or her reality in a context that drives his or her reactions with people.
So
Bishop may not have been the quote-unquote perfect employee, but what matters here is this encounter, and he didn't do anything wrong in trying to be at most a forceful advocate for his coworker.
But she didn't ask him to come. She didn't ask him to be her advocate, did she?
She assented to his presence when leaving the meeting in the break room, a fellow employee, yeah. Sharon Maida.
She said okay, right?
Stated, yeah, she NACO ultimately said okay and looked at Bishop, and that was evidence of a type of agreement that he
Bishop, should. The argument for Bishop would be more firmly grounded if she had asked him to come, right? I mean,
people can express their desire to do something in many different ways. I think this encounter happened the way it happened here, and what's clear is NACO did demonstrate that she wanted Bishop's presence. Bishop, after all, was not just another employee. He was the union shop steward and was trying to, you know, exercise his role in that regard. And the actions, the unlawful suspension, and ultimately the discharge are well supported and supported by substantial evidence. The after-the-fact attempt to pile on, if you will, by the company by pointing to alleged shortcomings or Bishop's allegedly subpar productivity was, as the board found, just too late and in this context blatantly pretextual. It was reasonable, as the board found, that had the company known about this, it should have known about this. It sat on this basically for 18 months. There are various other findings at issue. Well, let me back up first, if I could, to the Jefferson Standard issue and what Bishop was alleged to have done following his discharge. The board drew a reasonable distinction between current employees and former employees.
Well, I want to be clear. In your brief at page 45, you make this point about it was never raised on a motion for reconsideration, and therefore it's not properly before the court. And in your footnote 60, you cite the statute, a Supreme Court case, and precedent from this court.
Correct.
Are you sticking with that? Because I saw no response in the reply brief.
We are absolutely sticking with that, Your Honor. In this circumstance, what the board did, plain text of its decision, was apply the O'Daniel Oldsmobile standard, the unfit for further service standard. The company didn't say a word about the board's application of that standard. And what we're talking about here in that sense is what the board did, not what the judge did. The judge analyzed the matter under Jefferson standard, but here we firmly argue that the company, to preserve any argument it had regarding this matter insofar as O'Daniel Oldsmobile is involved, had to bring this argument to the board's attention, and it could have done that through a motion for reconsideration. It did not.
Bring which argument to the board's attention? The Jefferson standard applies? But it wasn't that the very argument they made before the ALJ?
They did make that argument, Your Honor. Let me clarify. What I'm saying is they were obligated, that is, the company was obligated to argue its position that the board erred in applying O'Daniel Oldsmobile, which it could only have done after the board did what it did. There's not a word from the company about, for instance, the board's analysis of Bishop's comments under the unfit for further service standard from O'Daniel Oldsmobile. So nothing from the company in that sense. And that,
the argument, just so I'm clear, just in a hypothetical, the board has this longstanding precedent, Jefferson Standard, and the company argues it applies and it should prevail under that standard. The ALJ rejects the company's argument. Then the case comes before the board, and the board says, we're overruling Jefferson Standard to the extent that our cases may have suggested it applies in a situation like this where the employee is no longer an employee of the employer. It's not enough to have argued that Jefferson Standard applies even in this circumstance. In other words, I just want to be clear, because I thought your answer to Judge Griffith suggested that what the company didn't do was to argue the facts in a motion for reconsideration as distinct from what I thought your brief was arguing, that there was a legal error here.
I'm sorry if I left.
And you may have meant that, but I just want to be clear about it.
Well, certainly they had an obligation to argue the facts insofar as there's a new matter, if you will, a different standard, two different facts. It certainly did not do that in raising this contention. I would argue further that it's a form of waiver because the company did not raise as a legal matter the board's application of O'Daniel Oldsmobile and the unfit for further service standard. In any event, Your Honor, nothing Bishop said following his discharge should deprive him of his reinstatement right or toll his back pay. His comments were at most a form of literary criticism.
Does your argument there depend on whether Jefferson Standard rightly applies or whether O'Daniel's Oldsmobile applies?
The argument is under O'Daniel.
Yeah. So under Jefferson Standard, you might not, if Jefferson Standard were the law, that might be grounds for not reinstating?
The board applied O'Daniel Oldsmobile, so I can't, you know, speculate beyond that. The judge found, obviously, under Jefferson Standard that the comments, you know, would not have, you know, taken.
Do you have any cases, I just don't have them in front of me, where under the statute we have said that you've effectively forfeited the argument by not pursuing a challenge to the board's change in its legal interpretation?
The cases, beyond the cases cited in the brief, not at this moment, Your Honor.
Did either one of those involve this kind of a situation? I don't recall.
I don't recall specifically, but we think that in this circumstance, the company had to say something before the board to preserve its argument that the board erred in applying O'Daniel Oldsmobile, and that it had as an option a motion for reconsideration, which it did not do. The Supreme Court case cited in our brief indicates that a motion for reconsideration could be the proper vehicle for preserving an objection. Aside from that, Your Honor, just to touch on briefly the other issues in this case, we've already heard about the tape recording, the board.
If there had been a company policy banning secret recordings before Smith went in there, how does that change the analysis here, or does it?
It's an interesting question, Your Honor. The board pointed to the absence of such a policy here, as well as the fact that this type of tape recording was not illegal in Hawaii.
But let's put a company policy in place.
Sure. I mean, that could potentially, of course, change the analysis if they had a policy in place.
So you're not arguing that there's some implicit exception to those policies to protect Weingarten right? When an employee reasonably thinks a Weingarten right may be in jeopardy, he or she may resort to secret recordings?
We're certainly not trying to indicate that we should trample on an employer's prerogative to manage its business and put in place whatever rules it thinks it should. It was simply in this circumstance, there was no such rule. It's not unlawful.
So when the employer later came around and created such a rule, the board faulted them for doing that. I don't understand why.
The board faulted the employer for doing that in this circumstance because of the timing of that action.
So how long does the company have to wait before they can put in place that policy?
I can't put a number on that, Your Honor. I think
it sounds like the board says they have to show that policy has nothing to do with this event. And
I think that's part of it. I think that there is a cease and desist order in place, but I don't believe that.
In other words, is the board looking for some indication by the employer that this is not just, these are my words, not the board's words, a knee-jerk reaction to an incident, but rather the company has given careful thought to exactly how it wants to operate? I mean, is it looking for some formal process? Because when I read that and I looked at one of the board cases, it just says, well, you know, it was in reaction to what we are holding is unlawful conduct. So therefore, the rule is invalid. And I'm not sure I understood what the board was getting at.
I think the board found ultimately that the rule came about as a result of the company's response to employees engaging in protected concerted activity and union activity. I'm not saying this is the standard, but for that activity, this rule in these circumstances would not have come about.
So Mr. Bach had gone to, who is the editor again, Mr.?
Mr. Cahill.
Cahill's the union.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Who's the publisher? Anyway, suppose he goes to the publisher of the newspaper and he says, you know, I just experienced this problem where, you know, this employee is taping his meeting with me. I think that's outrageous. And I think we ought to have a policy here that says that, you know, alerts all employees. You can't tape meetings and you can't tape them secretly. And the publisher says, I agree. and he sends out a letter to everybody. What's wrong with that? I just need to be clear.
There's nothing wrong with that in the abstract, Your Honor. What's wrong with it here is that it came about as a reaction to employees' protected concerted activity. Certainly nothing in this decision would intend to tie the hands of this employer or any employer from issuing work rules that don't interfere with rights arising under the Act.
We're only talking about a retroactive application, so.
I think so.
That's all the rule, surely the board's not suggesting the rule itself is unlawful. It's the retroactive application of it.
The retroactive application. If the rule is written in such a way that it doesn't single out protected concerted activity, that's all I'm at.
Judge Edwards has clarified the situation.
I don't understand what it's a retroactive, why are you laboring over it? It's a retroactive application of a rule, and you're saying you can have your rule, but you can't apply it backwards because it's discriminatory. You didn't have it before. So part of what you've done is you may have adopted a rule, new rule, which in, you know, now you realize, gee, this is a great rule, we ought to have this, but you did it in applying it to this person, it was clearly intended to be discriminatory.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So they can't apply it now, the rule?
The rule
can be applied prospectively? It's not invalid? I was under the impression that the board struck down the rule and the company can't have it until...
Yeah, I think your answer is after the court's decision, you're sure that they will be able to.
Right.
You don't know what the board had in mind. The board, to the extent that the board means to say that there can be no such rule, that's absurd.
Right,
Kim, don't even try and pursue the argument. Don't waste your breath on it.
Okay. I was just simply going to point to the provision of the order is what we
That's
have to do.
That's what order. I was pulling out, just to see exactly what the order is.
Promulgating
and... That part of the order may die, because that makes no sense. We're talking about retroactive application.
As a matter of compliance.
That's all we're talking about.
Okay, fair enough. The board's other findings are supported by substantial evidence. It's a myriad of unfair labor practices, Section 8A1 interrogations, and other things. And if there are no further questions about those matters.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Counsel for intervener.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
Matthew Ginsburg on behalf of the intervener Pacific Media Workers Guild. As Your Honors know, we focused our brief on the Jefferson Standard issue and the jurisdictional issue raised by the court. I'm happy.
Will Walkie and Romero cover this kind of a situation?
Judge, my view is that the petitioner pursued the pure legal argument that Jefferson Standard was the correct standard to apply here, both before the ALJ and before the board and then before this court. My reading of Welke and Romero is that that is argument, and only that argument, is therefore properly before this court. So, for example, the petitioner cannot argue that the board misapplied its O'Donnell automobile standard.
I thought really the fight would be over the change of the law. That would really be the, and whether or not you must pursue that with the board first. It seemed to me in looking at this that the employer would say that alleged correction of the law is wrong as a matter of law. I thought you were arguing is that, I thought your argument was they can't do that now. They can't raise that with us because they didn't present it to the board in the first place.
The argument we focused on the brief was on the board's authority to make this change in the law, which is not an argument that the petitioner is pursuing.
Right. That's saying the same thing.
Yes, that's correct, Judge.
I don't know what I feel about it, but I just want to make sure I understood what you were arguing.
And on the merits, the board certainly had authority, as we set forth in our brief, under the statute and certainly within a fair reading of Jefferson Standard, to make this change in the law, to go back to its 60-year-old practice of treating unlawfully discharged employees differently than current employees when evaluating their conduct. And so here they've cleaned up their law. They admitted there was some contrary precedent. They cleaned that up and went back to this longstanding practice, which is fully consistent with Section 10C of the statute. If this court has no further questions on this or any of the other issues, we'll rest on the arguments presented on the brief.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
All right. Counsel for petition.
Thank you.
you know, with the court's permission, I would be glad to address this issue in a letter after the hearing, argument whether or not we can pursue what Judge Edwards, because basically that is our position, that the change is wrong as a matter of law. With respect to their analysis under the Daniels Oldsmobile case, I didn't really see any analysis in the board's opinion other than we're shifting the Daniels Oldsmobile, and under Daniels Oldsmobile, we think everything's fine. And that's about the long and short of.
See, those are precisely the question we're raising. Those are precisely the two questions you would raise in a motion for reconsideration. One, you can't change the law. You changed the law, we're shocked, you can't do it, motion for reconsideration. And two, even if you think you can apply O'Donnell, you've misapplied it. We should win on that ground. That's exactly what I thought you would have to do in the motion for reconsideration. The board never had a shot at those arguments from you. They told you what they intended to do, and I thought the Romero case said, you know, in that kind of a situation, where something new comes up and you think it's wrong, that you have an obligation in order to preserve jurisdiction with us to say to the board, that is wrong. And then we have the benefit of their response to your claim. Your fight had been under Jefferson. You absolutely raised Jefferson and you waged your war under Jefferson. The board undercut that completely by saying it's an apposite. So when the board's decision comes out, all of what you had been fighting about was simply removed from the case. And it seems to me that's exactly the kind of case where you got to file a petition for reconsideration and say, oh, I didn't know you were going to make us fight on those terms. If that's the case, then you have to, we're filing a motion for reconsideration because you're wrong.
Could I address that after
today? Yeah, I'm curious to know what your answer is.
I'd like to, the court's permission to address that in writing after today.
Well, I don't know how my colleagues feel, but the point is the board is supposed to get the first opportunity to address these arguments, not the court, because we benefit from the board's expertise in these areas. Not that we would necessarily not take arguments against them seriously, but I don't think filing a post-argument motion is going to solve the problem. I don't know if Judge Griffith agrees.
Yeah. I would just note that under the board rules and regulations that they were directed to sue in their brief, it says the motion for reconsideration need not be filed to exhaust administrative remedies, and so that's.
Mm-hmm. We understand that we're talking about the statutory requirement, mm-hmm. the court's jurisdiction.
All right. Do you want to move on to other arguments?
I'd like to address briefly the access issue. I think the employer had a reasonable legal access rule for access to its premises.
This is supposed to be rebuttal to the board's argument, not new argument. All right, we assume that the matters in your brief remain the matters you wish to press before the court, but if you had any response to something that counsel for the board stated or intervener's counsel stated, then we would like to hear it now.
No, I have nothing further on that, Your Honor.
All right, well, thank you. We'll take the case under advisement.